This is the fourth day of this October 2011 7-day sesshin. We'll resume reading from a book called Zen Dawn, which are the early Zen texts discovered at the Dunhuang Caves in China. It's translated by J.C. Cleary. We're on a section of the book called The Records of the Teachers and Students of the Lanka, just little short biographies. Not so much biographies, as little extracts of teachings from the earliest Zen teachers, beginning with Gunabhadra and now Bodhidharma, is where we left off yesterday. He was talking about the four practices. First, he talked about entering the way through awakening, and now he's referring to the entering through the four practices. The first is the practice of repaying wrongs. Second, the practice of going along with the causal nexus. And now, the third, the practice of not seeking anything. Worldly people are always deluded, craving everything, becoming attached everywhere. This is called seeking. The wise awaken to the real. Using inner truth, they reach the conventional world. Pacifying mind without contrived activity, changing shape as they go, the myriad states of being are thereby emptied. Let me just pause. Bodhidharma strings a lot of things together here. Just first, worldly people are always deluded, craving everything, becoming attached everywhere. Well, to be fair, although it's true that monks relinquish a lot by when they enter their monastic, take their monastic vows, it's not like monks aren't also craving. It's just they have a lot fewer options. A lot gets loaded into food. A lot of that craving gets loaded into food, and there's the other thing I saw in my pilgrimages is just a lot of interest in robes and every aspect of robes and getting the robes all just right. There isn't a lot else that they can get attached to, but well, there's rules, of course. Monks can get terribly attached to rules and regulations. It's one thing to honor and comply with rules and regulations, as we do in sesshin, which are all designed to simplify things for us so that we can practice most effectively. It's another thing to become obsessed with monastic rules and regulations and get into one-upmanship with how many, how strictly one upholds rules. So for him to say worldly people are always deluded, craving everything, well, let's just say people are always deluded, craving everything that's available to them, which just means a lot more for lay people than monks. This referring to the wise, they use inner truth, they pacify mind without contrived activity, changing shape as they go. this refers to the adaptability and the fluidity that comes from practice, that we develop through practice. A novice monk is in Japan is called unsui, which means clouds and water. Clouds and water are much admired in Zen because of their quality of adaptability and, well, no self, no attached self, just adapting to changing causes and conditions. The myriad states of being are thereby emptied. I couldn't help but think of Sesshin, particularly with this phrase, the myriad states of being are thereby emptied. In Sesshin, especially in the early one's early Sesshins, one does go through many states of being. But through this continuous practice of the breath or the koan or shikantaza, one eventually becomes emptied of these different states. That is, one, it just means one gets beyond them, one gets through them, and is less caught in them. In this second half of Sesshin that we are beginning now, we're more susceptible to makyo than in the first half of Sesshin. Certainly these present different mind states or states of being, but we can continually free ourselves of bondage to these states just by first of all recognizing them as makyo, and then not getting involved, mentally involved with these different states. So states such as hallucinations, emotional states, crying, states of fear, of dejection, of euphoria. It's a ride. It's really quite a wild ride in one's early sesshins, especially. It all comes down to recognizing different states as just that, as makyo, as transitory states, and then not getting caught in them, not getting captivated by them. And then he goes on, along with this, the darkness of meritorious deeds is forever banished. And after meritorious deeds is in quotation marks, and then the translator put in brackets after it, contrived based on dualistic views. So as far as I can tell, what Bodhidharma means by this, the darkness of meritorious deeds is forever banished, is getting caught up in thinking in terms of merit and lack of merit, good karma and bad karma. This is not a desirable state to get into. It's a kind of a accounting state, always concerned with the effects of one's actions, whether one is adding to one's merit bank account or withdrawing from it. He goes on, dwell for long in the triple world, it is like a house on fire. A triple world just means means samsara, basically, the world of birth and death. It is like a house on fire. This is an allusion to a sutra in which the Buddha talks about this existence as it's like we're on fire. Constantly in a state of impermanence or perishing. And then along the same lines, he said, all who have bodies suffer. Who can find peace? Another translation, maybe it's the same, a different translation of the same line. The one I remembered is by Bodhidharma. Is anyone who has a body is an heir to suffering and a stranger to peace. Very sobering, really. If we can let this sink in. Everybody who has a body, that would be all of us, is an heir to suffering. And a stranger to peace. This acquires more of a bite as we get older and our bodies start giving way in all kinds of ways and our minds. But even young people can empathize, can appreciate what's behind this, at least in the, when they're in the presence of someone who's very old and is suffering with aches and pains and various states of deterioration, mental and physical deterioration. When this is completely comprehended, thoughts of the various states of being cease, and there is no seeking. The sutra says, all who seek suffer. If there is no seeking, only then is there bliss. And then he adds, thus we know that not seeking anything is truly a practice of the path. This passage, this clause here, thoughts of the various states of being cease and there is no seeking. I suppose you could say that he's referring to any of the states of longing to be something other than what we are, to be somewhere other than where we are. This kind of craving. Once we see that wherever we are, whatever we are, we are still inhabiting this samsaric existence and are therefore subject to the depredations of impermanence. But when we stop wanting to be something else or somewhere else, someone else, that's when we can free ourselves of this bind. The thing about desire is that no matter how much we get what we are desiring, we are still left wanting. It's never enough. It's never enough to extinguish the habit of desire. People with the most stupendous wealth, Carlos Slim of Mexico is the world's richest man, Bill Gates. These guys, does anyone think that they have no more desire or cravings for more? Now maybe seeking, since he keeps repeating the word seeking, maybe that refers more to the kind of desire to not to just acquire more goods, more wealth or whatever, but to evolve into a higher state of being, maybe, like to seek enlightenment. And this is a sensitive point about practice. You come across this in the old texts, not to seek. Sometimes they say not to strive. These great masters say, whatever you do, don't strive. And that can be confusing. What do you mean? We're not supposed to strive? What are we doing here in Sesshin, in our practice? All this effort? We're not supposed to strive? But it really means the way in which one is applying effort. Or rather the mind state out of which one is making one's effort. If it's one of grasping, of wanting to get something for oneself, this is what leads to more suffering. But there's a big difference between grasping at something to get something for oneself, between that and working toward enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. However we phrase it, the important thing is not to be have a goal in the mind, because that's the problem, is that dualistic state. I'm here and I want to be out there, I want to be that. This is a fundamental illness, seeking to be somewhere or something else. If we're working on a koan, working to resolve a koan, it's not to, in its purest, it's not to just acquire something, but it's to understand something. That's all the difference. To understand what is mu. Understand what is this? Who am I? Who is this? Questioning is not seeking. Questioning is questioning. Wondering is not seeking. It's not grasping. It's wondering. It's all the difference in the world. And then now he gets to the fourth of these practices, the practice of according with the Dharma. This is more subtle. The Dharma, the teaching of reality, is based on the inner truth of the inherent purity of all things' true identity. By this inner truth, the multitude of forms are all empty. There is no defilement, no attachment, no this, no that. The sutra says, the Dharma has no sentient beings because it is detached from the impurity of sentient beings. The Dharma has no self because it is detached from the impurity of self. And then Bodhidharma speaks again. If the wise can believe and understand with certainty this inner truth, they ought to practice in accord with the Dharma. Well, this is... Here he goes right to the very marrow of the Dharma, of the Zen school and Buddhism, actually, which is the teaching of no-thingness, shunyata. That all things are essentially devoid of any substance. And this is where faith can help, but in any case, it is only through awakening that this is confirmed, this no-thingness of things. This world of phenomena, and phenomena means every single conceivable thing, mental or physical, this world of phenomena gives the appearance of reality, of substance, maybe. But in fact, that is illusory. There is nothing. I have a scroll hanging in my quarters in Rochester, at Arnold Park, that was hanging there for many years. When Roshi Kaplow was living there, he got it, and it was done. The painting was done by the assistant Roshi at Hoshinji. Sesui Roshi was his name. It's one of the favorite subjects of calligraphy, and it reads, "From the very beginning, there has never been a single thing." From the very beginning, there's never been a single thing. All of this is illusion. This is completely contrary to the evidence of our senses. But our senses deceive us. We don't see with our ordinary vision and hearing and so forth. We don't see this void nature of things. Physicists now recognize and declare that this world of things is actually, yes, energy. It's so remarkable to hear the teaching of the Dharma expounded by scientists say that, well, just that. Bodhidharma continues, the body of the Dharma is not stingy with the physical body and life. This is practicing giving. Now this, we're back to the first of the six paramitas, six perfections. Let there be no stinginess or holding back in the heart. Realizing that the one receiving the gift, the giver, and the gift itself are all empty, you don't depend on them or get attached to them. They are just used to get rid of impurities and embrace and transform sentient beings without grasping at forms. This is not the smoothest, most accessible translation. I mean, the translator may have done the best anyone could do, but it is a little difficult at times. When he says they are just used to get rid of impurities, it seems to be meaning that the gift, the giver, and the gift, the one receiving the gift, the giver, and the gift itself are just used to get rid of impurities. So it's a way of, as a form of relinquishment, giving is a way to purify ourselves of our natural tendencies to want to cling to things and to everything, basically. By developing, through the practice of relinquishment, of giving, this is a way of purifying ourselves of those tendencies of clutching and holding on to things. You know, practice really is everything, because each one of us is an amalgam of habit forces, and we developed over time, over lifetimes, we've developed certain habit forces such as clinging, and then it takes repetition, it takes practice and work to reshape or to change these habits. We can't just make up our minds that we're going to no longer be stingy or withholding. We need to practice it. We need to do it. And do it, and do it, and do it, and do it. He goes on, this is benefiting oneself and also being able to benefit others and being able to adorn the path of enlightenment. Since the perfection of giving is thus, so are the other five. The perfection of morality, patient endurance, effort, meditation, and wisdom. To practice the six perfections, to remove false thinking, and yet to have nothing that is practiced. This is the practice of according with the Dharma. So, in all of these, to do them without any attachment to the notion of oneself doing them. This is the perfection of the practice. Very advanced state, really. But until we reach such a state of purity, we can still do it, even though it may not be the purest motivation behind it. Even there may be some element of begrudging, or resistance, or withholding, just by doing these things, then we're on our way. You see how absolutely essential meditation is, because it is through a daily practice of meditation that we can more easily give, for example. without as many thoughts in the mind, it's just easier to give. Because it's thoughts, basically, that make up our tendency to withhold. Then we switch to the voice of the monk who compiled this text. He says, these four practices were personally expounded by the Chan master Bodhidharma. He says, the great teacher Bodhidharma would point to things and ask their meaning. He would just point to something. What is it? Still quoting Bodhidharma, what is it? There is a multitude of things. Question them all. Interchange their names. And with them changed, question them. For the sake of people who are listening to this, who are working on the practice of what is it, let me repeat this. What is it? There is a multitude of things. Question them all. Interchange their names. And with them changed, question them. He also said, does this body exist or not? What body is this body? Does this body exist or not may seem at first to be a kind of a silly question. Sure, seems to exist, but that's the key word. It seems to. It gives the appearance of existing. But in fact, we know that every single molecule of our body is in a state of change. Is in a state of flux. So is that existing or not existing? As soon as we say it is, here, the body is. Well, that's not quite true. It's energy in flux. He also said, the clouds in the sky can never stain the empty sky, but they can cover over the sky so that it is not bright and clear. Again, this excellent metaphor, simile for practice, for the mind and thoughts. And then Bodhidharma's successor was Hui Ke. And the text continues, the one who took it up after the Chan master Bodhidharma was the Chan master Hui Ke. At the age of 14, he met Bodhidharma, who was traveling and teaching in the region. Hui Ke served him for 6 years, investigating the one vehicle with pure energy and drawing near to the abstruse inner truth. Hui Ke, our China pilgrims came back and reported that it should be pronounced Hui Ke. Anyway, gave an outline account of cultivating the path and of the essential method for illuminating mind, whereby one truly reaches the fruit of enlightenment. The Lankavatara Sutra says, Shakyamuni contemplated in stillness and thus left birth and death far behind. This is called not grasping. And then this one is very memorable. Of all the enlightened ones of the 10 directions, past and present, there is not one who became Buddha without a basis in sitting meditation. Well, we know that there are rare people who have come to genuine enlightenment without having done any sitting meditation. So this really refers to someone of full enlightenment. The Ten Stages Sutra says, within the bodies of sentient beings, there is an indestructible enlightened nature. It is like the orb of the sun. Its body is bright, round, and full. Its light, vast and boundless. Because it is covered over by the layered clouds of the five skandhas, sentient beings do not see it. So the five skandhas could take us, if we got into trying to detail these, we could take us far afield, but it's the components of an individual existence. And so they are, the five skandhas, well, our form, that is our physical form, sensation, perception, tendencies, which are sometimes are called mental formations, that is, most mental activities, the act of will, attention, discrimination, joy, happiness, resolve, exertion, compulsion, concentration. These are all one of the five skandhas. And the fifth is consciousness itself. These we touch on very lightly in the Prajnaparamita. Form, feeling, thought, choice, consciousness. Choice is just a simple word that works better for chanting rather than saying tendencies or mental formations. Because it is covered over by the layered clouds of the five skandhas, sentient beings do not see it. If you encounter the wind of wisdom, it blows away the five skandhas. When the layers of clouds are totally gone, the enlightened nature is shining perfectly bright, clear, and pure. This is all quoting from this sutra. And then another sutra, the Huayan Sutra. It is as vast as the universe, as ultimate as the void. But it is also like a light in a jar that cannot illuminate the outside. Meaning it's not perceived by everyone. Another simile is this. When clouds close in on all sides and the world is darkened, how can the sunlight be bright and clear? The sunlight has not been destroyed. It is just covered over and blocked off by the clouds. The pure reality nature of sentient beings is also like this. It cannot become fully manifest precisely because layers upon layers of clouds, meaning afflictions, the perceptions of false thoughts clinging to objects, cover over and block off the path of the sages. If false thoughts are not born and you sit in silent purity, the sun of great nirvana is spontaneously bright and clear. And then the text goes on, a worldly book, we don't know what that is, says, ice is born from water, but ice can block water. Ice is solid, whereas water flows. That's the end of the quotation. And then I guess this monk who wrote this text said, similarly, falsity arises from the real, and falsity can lose the real in delusion. When falsity is ended, the real appears. The mind see is clear and pure. The body of reality is empty and clean. So this was maybe was the original source of what we recite in the Hakuin chant, like water and ice, without water no ice, outside us no Buddhas. So our nature is like that of water, infinitely accommodating, adaptable, fluid, dynamic, without any fixity, but in the form of ice, it blocks us. And yet ice is in its nature water. Text goes on, if you completely comprehend the clear purity of the mind source, then all vows are fulfilled, all practices are completed, all is accomplished. You are no longer subject to states of being. For those who find this body of reality, the numberless sentient beings are just one good person, the one person who has been there in accord with this through a million billion eons. The sentence, the numberless sentient beings are just one good person. It's referring, of course, to our true nature, our true self. If pure energy and true integrity are not generated within you, it accomplishes nothing even if you encounter countless Buddhas past, present, and future. Thus we know that sentient beings liberate themselves by knowing mind. The Buddhas do not liberate the sentient beings. If the Buddhas could liberate sentient beings, since we have met countless Buddhas in the past, why haven't we become enlightened? It is just because pure energy and integrity have not been generated within. So here he's making the point that it really has to come from each one of us, from within. A teacher cannot confer enlightenment on us. And what we need to generate or mobilize is what is called here pure energy and true integrity. I think the energy is released. The energy is mobilized through the integrity. And by integrity, one way to understand this is non-separation. Not two means being one with the practice, not doing it with part of the mind and having another part of the mind flitting about, doing it with an observer over our shoulder, but but integrating subject and object, fusing mind and the object of our meditation, the breath or the koan. This is samadhi. This is a very advanced state, but it is one that is within the reach of everyone here, doing all this sitting, 10, 12 more hours a day. Every person here has the ability to reach this kind of integrity, this oneness with the practice. And out of that absorption, that non-separation, that oneness, comes great energy. Each one of us is energy. It's not that we, even that we just have all this energy. We are energy. We are nothing but energy. And that energy is normally blocked by our trafficking in thoughts. But when we can refrain from dwelling in our thoughts and become one with the practice, then we find great resources of energy flowing. Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.